Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, poised to blow on our dandelion clock of culture stories from the week. Whew. This time we drop into the Holy Well in Phoenix Park for a mouthful of healing water with artist Carmen Quigley, and Evie artist escapes the terrors of quantization with the help of his laptop, and Orit Gat visits an exhibition of contemporary artists looking at the family. But first, in the coming years, lawyers are going to fight some of their most lucrative cases over AI and copyright. The opening battles have already started, with the New York Times taking on OpenAI, and now the RIAA taking on AI companies specializing in music, both plaintiffs claiming that the AI companies are built on materials they have no right to use. But as Jennifer Walsh, who most certainly has data in the game, sees it, the corporations and their lawyers might be missing some crucial shifts in culture.
Recently, the Recording Industries Association of America initiated legal proceedings against two AI music companies called Suno and Udio, accusing both of massive copyright infringement. The RIAA spearheaded the case, but they weren't alone. The largest labels in America, including Universal Music Group, Sony, Atlantic, and Warner, are all co-plaintiffs. The major complaint in the case is over the datasets that Suno and Udio train their networks on. The RIAA make their viewpoint extremely clear in the lawsuit. Suno and Udio have created datasets consisting of copyrighted recorded music without asking permission or compensating any of the musicians or labels involved. Suno and Udio both work very similarly. The user types a simple prompt into a context window, for example, up-tempo EDM track about falling in love, and the system uses AI to churn out a track. Both systems can write lyrics, or the user can supply their own. Neither company has ever disclosed publicly what training data they use, and Udio in particular will flag any prompt reference to a real artist as impermissible, yet it's very easy to get both platforms to generate tracks which sound like pre-existing music. The lawsuit gives the example of Prancing Queen, an ABBA sound-alike track generated in Suno. I myself have easily generated many tracks which sound extremely similar to artists such as Joy Division, Sun Ra, and Kraftwerk. What's curious to me, though, is that right now the most enthusiastic use of these platforms falls into a category which, from a legal perspective, is somewhat protected. That's because the most popular outputs are comedy songs and memes. YouTube is full of examples of these songs, parodies of 1980s corporate rock, of Chuck Berry, earnest 1960s folk. The most viral output Udio has produced to date, though, is a song called BBL Drizzy. BBL Drizzy was generated by comedian King Willonius. The title and lyrics refer to claims that Canadian rapper Drake had a Brazilian butt lift. I'm not going to get into that here, just feel free to Google it on your own time. King Willonius' song had moderate success when it was released in April, but shot to fame when, in the midst of the Kendrick Lamar-Drake diss battle, producer Metro Boomin sampled BBL Drizzy without permission to create what he referred to as a diss track beat. Metro Boomin then released his version called BBL Drizzy BPM 150 and offered $10,000 to the best person to freestyle over it. Millions of plays and viral fame ensued, with people not only rapping over it, but also remixing the track in a wide variety of genres. BBL Drizzy isn't so much a track as an AI-powered activity that people engage in order to interact with different rap fandoms and the real-world feud at their center. Where in this chain of sampling and remixing does ownership of the fixed text reside? BBL Drizzy makes it clear people will use AI to generate material, sure, but then humans will get enthusiastically involved in shaping and reshaping that material. That today, as far as many listeners are concerned, a song can and even should be freely reworked, responding and reacting to other versions of itself. I'm a musician, and my music has been recorded, and there's no doubt that it's part of the huge datasets that Udio and Suno trained their networks on. I have a stake in the outcome of the lawsuit because, like all musicians, I would like to be compensated for my work. But I also think the lawsuit fails to realistically look at how people use music now, at what music has become, at what people expect to be able to do with it. Because that has nothing to do with the idea of copyright. It's about money and fame, sure, but copyright seems to matter less than clicks, than the ability of a song to shapeshift across the timeline into remixes and memes, maintaining its virality by any means possible.
Jennifer Walsh there with her latest Things Know Things. And don't forget to consume all previous things on the Culture File podcast feed or the Lyric site. A trip to the well below the valley, oh, next. Artist Carmen Quigley is best known for her intricate, writhing monochrome drawings with mystical flavours informed by her own highly partial, wry explorations of local myths and history. One of Quigley's recurring draws is to water sources, and in particular Ireland's holy wells, which she seeks out, visits, and, under the right circumstances, drinks from in excursions that are part research trip, part performance. Culture File's Vanessa Noonan joined her recently at a Hidden in Plain Sight location in Dublin's Phoenix Park.
I'm Carmen Quigley. I'm a visual artist based in Dublin. And for the last couple of years, I've been making a lot of work about holy wells and different sites of folkloric interest around Ireland. And so, yeah. So I primarily make drawings, and they are inspired by the places that I visit. When I go somewhere, I want to like get a sense of the place, a feel for the place, and then I use reference photos and just like memory of those places to make drawings that make up my own stories that are heavily inspired by Irish folklore but aren't exact retellings. They're kind of existing in the same world but just not as familiar.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh yeah. Oh, it is. Oh no.
So we're at Baker's Well, or it's also known as Bridget's Well. It's in Phoenix Park next to Knockmaroon Gate.
We're just off the road, and the hill dips pretty steeply, and you really quickly get to a very overgrown ditch that's got loads of sort of long grass and brambles and nettles. Looking immediately to your left, you see
a small stone structure?
Yeah, a small stone structure that's going down into the ground.
Three little steps down?
Three sort of granite slab steps go down into a little sort of walled area. Well, when you're looking at it, you see a pretty unpromising layer of sludge. And then when you go down and turn left, is a little sort of hole into the ground that's covered with more granite in the shape of a sort of peaked roof with 1894 carved on it. And then down the bottom is a small pool of clear water and a little stream, a mossy little tap that's letting a trickle of water in.
Oh, Napoleon.
Yeah. 1894. Well, you can tell me more about that, I guess.
I don't know much about it.
It's really nice.
And it could be the Fionnuala Well. What is it? Clear water. So Phoenix Park's obviously called Fionnuala in Irish because of the bodies of water around. And I think this well was used quite like domestically, which some wells you're not supposed, it's kind of frowned upon to use the water for domestic purposes. So like washing or anything like that, you're not supposed to do that. But I think this one might have been actually collected by people in the area and used for kind of domestic things. And I'm not sure what its healing properties are, because a lot of wells are attributed to a specific cure, and I couldn't find anything about this one, so could just be general healing. But even down there, I can't see very many offerings left. Lots.
No.
Yeah, there was kind of, they're few and far between over there. There's like often if you go to some of the more regularly visited ones, you'll have like a rag tree and you'll have lots of different
okay, let's maybe make
offerings
our way back
left
out.
For the well.
Come.
Well, I made a drawing for the Project Art Centre for the billboard outside there, and it was specifically about Dublin holy wells because so many of them are lost or just kind of difficult to get to, or they're inside a church, or there's one in the Mansion House. It used to be like an actual well, and then they
built a house on top of it.
Yeah, and they also have connected it to the main water line now, so it's not even, it's got no special properties anymore. But yeah, the drawing was inspired by how many of them are kind of behind a gate or, you know, enclosed somewhere, hard to access. So it was about them like basically flooding Dublin and healing Dublin with all of their magical properties. That was kind of after visiting a lot of more rural ones and just seeing how lovely those were. And I sometimes feel quite moved by them. They have a really strong energy to them. Probably one of the most memorable ones that I went to was in Kerry, and it was in this tiny graveyard, and it was next to this mound, and it was a mass grave from the famine times. And so there's this beautiful little well next to it, and this obviously
very nice,
like devastating graveyard. That's one that really sticks out to me, just because the energy of that well was palpable. It was one of my favorites, maybe is the wrong word to say, but most memorable.
Ooh,
for sure.
Bees down here now.
There's bees?
Yeah.
Most of the time I just drink from them, but the ones in Dublin, sometimes I don't want to drink from them. So I either take it with me in my belly or in a bottle.
It's nice yeah. and cold.
Something I always like to stress to people is that I'm like, I wouldn't consider myself a historian in any way, because I don't like retain any facts really. I'll remember the well based on my experience there, as opposed to what I read about it somewhere, and that has changed the way I make up my drawings as well.
Is it the Liffey kind of water?
I definitely recommend people start visiting wells. I think there is nothing like it. Like, truly, I'm sorry that I found this well before we we met up, because the joy of just like turning around the corner and seeing it, like I was positively giddy. And then even like standing down into the steps and looking in, like obviously that thin layer of sludge is there, but then turning your head and seeing like the crystal clear fresh water. Oh, it's so beautiful. I just,
I
love it a lot.
Yeah, I might taste a drop too. How is it?
Delicious.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Thank you. Might I?
Bottoms up.
Delicious.
Yeah, it's really, really nice. And whatever cure it holds, we will now be cured.
Yes. Perfect.
Artist Carmen Quigley there, taking the waters with our reporter Vanessa Noonan. And you can see more of Carmen's work on Instagram at carquig, all one word. Burning down the house next with the help of Orit Gat. This time correspondent has been to visit an exhibition in St. Gallen in Switzerland. Burning Down the House, Rethinking the Family has encouraged contemporary artists to make work about the family, an idea so large, as one scholar recently pointed out, that it doesn't even feel like an idea anymore. These are Orit Gat's voice notes.
In the main hall of the Kunstmuseum St. Gallen, just by the entrance to the exhibition, Burning Down the House, Rethinking Family, there is a permanent installation by Swiss artist Pipilotti Rist. It has a large woolly green area rug, two massive red vinyl couches, each over 2 meters tall, and a television monitor which looks like a joke out of Alice in Wonderland that you can watch video art on using, you guessed it, an oversized remote control. It's not part of the show I'm here to see, but it fits. It makes the living room into something grotesque and weird. It makes you question how much living is done in this kind of room. And all I can think of is how much I hated watching television with my ex-husband, because watching television in the living room spelled out something I suspected about marriage, that it offered inherently boring evenings on the couch in front of the telly, and still, that it would be hard, almost impossible to imagine marriage or any other kind of family structure differently. I am interested in this exhibition about family, not because I was married or because I am someone's daughter, someone's sibling, but exactly because I wonder if maybe art can help with this idea that it's so hard to see the family differently. I am interested in this exhibition about family, not because I was married or because I am someone's daughter, someone's sibling, but exactly because I wonder if maybe art can help with this idea that it's so hard to see the family differently. So I walk into the show, and the first work on view is a painting by Japanese artist Kyoko Idetsu called Safe House from 2022. It shows a couple holding hands within a frame that looks like a home, but their happy image is set against a background of crying and screaming characters and hands reaching out toward the couple. Next to the painting is writing in pencil directly on the wall. It reads, "I saw a woman being interviewed in a documentary. She said the police broke into her house in the middle of the night and shot her husband dead for no reason. I was watching the documentary in the safety of my home. At that time, all I could think about was how I could share the household chores with my husband." In the background are nursery rhymes. Coming from the next room, they sound familiar and faint. As I get near, the lyrics become more clear. Grow, 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 regrets tangle inside me. I can't have kids. I'll be the end of my family tree. The old rule book must bend and break, bend and break, bend and break. Extended family takes the weight when life gets crazy. Co-parenting's not anarchy. It's one of multiple rhymes that artist Louise Ashcroft compiled based on conversations with child-free or childless people. The gentle songs, titled No Kids Nursery Rhymes from 2024, fight for effect with Nina Byer's Beast from 2018, which is two huge mechanical bulls carrying plastic tanks filled with baby formula on their backs. These sculptures are actually in the collection of the museum. Sometimes, the right thing was there all along. The weirdness and playfulness of the rodeo bulls completes this show by signaling something about parenting, something unclear and haunting that perhaps rejects care, but also mirrors it by being in endless motion. Struggles, stories, sound, indecisiveness, sadness. Burning Down the House introduces the idea of family from several angles, as a lived experience, as a social construct, and as something to critique. It's not all negative, but it is all reflexive. Curator Melanie Bueller gathers works about family that reflect on subjects from love to the time parenting requires. Here in Ghislaine Long's work, where she paints her schedule on the gallery wall, the majority of the time is earmarked for childcare and a few hours a week for studio time. The show touches on big issues. Money and education and forms of relation and how you look at your parents as an adult and how you look at your friends as parents. One of my favorite works is Lily Vanderstoker's Biba Baby Boomer, with a pink couch and a floral carpet next to it and a mural of flowers and writing. The text reads, "Most of my female friends have babies and always talk about pregnancy stuff like breastfeeding." It's from 2003 but is ongoing, meaning Vanderstoker is still wondering how to relate to her friends, which is another form of love. Family would seem like a private, insular form of relation that we constantly negotiate. Berea Dillon's 2024 work, Soul Responsibility, Age 12 but Above 9, is a story of how her family history is defined by the state. She presents two souls cut in crystal and hanging on opposite walls. One stands in for her grandmother's foot, and the other for her uncle's when he was 12, the age he joined his mother in the UK. The souls are there because of the rule that stipulates a minor will only be granted a visa if both their parents reside in the UK, unless the UK-based parent has sole responsibility. In another work about the family in public, in the 1980s, Dutch artist Pink de Thierry made works using her own family performing a picture-perfect image. On view here are three photos from the series At Home, in which Pink, her husband and her child inhabited public spaces in the city centers of three Dutch cities, Haarlem, Bergen, and Middelburg, pretending to live their daily lives against a painting of a suburban middle-class home. Who knows how much the little girl in the photos understood how eerie it is to perform as a family when you are a family, making your own experience into an artifice. There are a lot of kids here anyway. Burning down the house includes multiple perspectives on what family is, but many of which respond to a single idea, something that relates to continuity, to children, something that drags the past into the future. Also, something that the capitalist system has encouraged, from voting rights to land ownership and inheritance laws. The nuclear family has been used in modern societies to keep people in their lane. The nuclear family is a known problem. What's left to say? What's left is perhaps to climb up Reist's huge sofa and not turn on the television. Just look at the world from a new perspective and try to imagine other ways of being with people, other forms of relation that may work better for all of us, mom, dad, child, household of one or of many. This exhibition tells us a story about our world and how we live in it, and also that perhaps looking at art can teach us how to imagine that it could be different.
Orit Gat's voice notes there, and she was talking about burning down the house, rethinking family at the Kunstmuseum St. Gallen, Switzerland, which runs into September. Over the coming weekend, the National Concert Hall in Dublin is a setting for a series of unexpected musical conversations, bringing together artists such as the band Soda Blonde with the National Symphony Orchestra, and our guest this time, E, the artist, who's teamed up with Crash Ensemble for the early evening Saturday spot. E, the artist, is the performing name of Darani Josana, an Irish Yoruba sound and visual artist who's using the collaboration for a journey into contemporary and vintage African and diasporic sounds. Culture Files' Louise McMahon visited E, the artist, at his base in the Daylight Social Centre in Glasnevin as he worked with a MIDI demo of the performance.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Hi, it's nice to meet you too. This is Daylight Social Centre, which is my studio, but it's also an amazing community organised space for events and just studios upstairs and everything. I was really fortunate to be contacted by Foggy Notions to do this. Yeah, this collaboration with Crash Ensemble. Yeah, we're just upstairs.
Okay, I'll follow you.
I've kind of composed this piece of music that was reconstructing like footwork music, which is from Chicago, as well as like bebop all the way to like what John Coltrane was doing with modal jazz. I kind of wanted to give a bit of a timeline for how African Americans have really innovated by just using technology and methods that were seen as lesser before. Afropunk, Afrofuturism, juke, footwork, jungle music, drum and bass music in their purest forms.
What is your genre with Crash?
Afro-surrealism. In 1965, John Coltrane went to Japan to play, and this was the first time that jazz music was really recognized in East Asia. And it was also around the same time that A Love Supreme released, and just a little earlier that jazz music was being respected in the West in general, especially in the USA, because it was seen as kind of lesser, and it was seen as what rap music is maybe perceived as today. It was seen in such a way until it went to Europe, and Europeans were like, oh, there's actually more to this. This is an innovation. And then Americans started to respect it because white Europeans were. I Love Supreme and Om are very inspired by the microtonal sounds. These are things that have been intrinsic in Eastern cultures, as opposed to like a 12-tone scale. So by Coltrane coming over here and presenting them with something that they already know, it's kind of a familiar and the unfamiliar, and that's what I was trying to do with my piece. So like I'm using like Japanese iwato scales towards the end and using like rounds and such.
Would you mind showing me your approach to composing something like that, or to translating your ideas out with this laptop that you have in front of you?
Yeah. So the digital audio workstation is FL Studio. There's a VST called Labs that has all of these free sounds. They have cellos and such. So at the start of the piece, there is a reworking of Ahmed Jamal's I Love Music. So I'll just...
You played the chords out with MIDI, which you drew in. And just below it on the screen, you have an audio file, and that's something that you've sampled and looped.
So if I were to take out the cello, here's the chords. And all of that kind of stuff is really inspired by like what Brian McKnight and what Boyz II Men were doing in the 90s. When you feel out every single note, like for example this one, like those three chords, because the first one is so drawn out and each note is individually played, it really adds like these internal rhythms to the work. So what I'm just doing there is playing triplets with the cello and then using the free bass sound as well as the free drum sound in Labs to kind of create this rumble, which is really important for footwork music. I think it's called The Home by people from Chicago.
There's percussive elements. They sound like jazz flourishes. You hear that. Would you call that like a tribal beat, like a typical Yoruba tribal beat, any of that?
Maybe it is. Like quite a lot of my musical intuition comes from that kind of stuff, but all jazz drumming comes from African drumming, because like the use of triplets in such a way that isn't strict. If you talk to a jazz drummer compared to a classical drummer, they'll talk more about the actual physical technique of playing it, as opposed to like a, it's this note and it's this note. We have this drum that you're able to play out different vocal tones through, and you can kind of express proverbs and such, but express them in like a super rhythmic way. So the kick that's there is slightly pitched. There's a bit of reverb on it, so it's not as clear here, but it's gonna be pitched to sound slightly like a talking drum, which is this amazing Yoruba instrument. I guess as Europeans started to write music out on notational sheets, the focus on jamming and the focus on the experience of actually hearing somebody play the music is much, much more prevalent in West African music and in Yoruba music. Like if you could see the screen now, nothing's necessarily on the grid. So by removing the strictness of quantization, I think that is one of the most beautiful parts of West African drumming in general. And that's kind of what I try to express. I asked somebody what his favorite color was before when I was 8 years old, and he was like, it depends on what colors are around it. And like, that's a very, I think approaching things as such, approaching the bigger picture of things, approaching the experience of something is much more important than getting into the intricacies of what is this specific detail and like.
What color is your music?
Black, kind of very proudly, because just living in Ireland for most of my life, it's like the way that I talk is regarded as black, regardless of what I say. So I think there's nothing I can do about that, so why not embrace it?
Edie Artist there with Louise the Reporter. Music Town's Dreaming of New Collaborations runs at the NCH from Friday to Sunday this week. musictown.ie for all the details. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back next week with more off-the-grid rhythms. Till then, bye now.